Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, Can He Pivot? As the lighting market shifts and competition mounts, Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda may be facing the greatest challenge of his career. And that's the headline on the front page. The article starts inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, The Move to Keep the Bright Lights On. Under pressure from global competition and pricing challenges, Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda finds himself at an innovation crossroads. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Ask Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda, and he'll tell you the secret to his success is taking risks. You just have to win more than you lose, he said to a group of business executives recently. The Durham-based public company, born in the 1980s from the bright ideas of NC State University graduate students, now 7,000 employees strong, captured President Obama's attention last year for its next-generation technology. But thanks to some drastic changes in product pricing, industry shift, and lackluster demand, Cree management, including its board, is under the gun. Top-line revenue is down. The stock price today is about where it was 10 years ago. And inventory levels are stacking up, both at its sprawling Durham headquarters and at its facilities overseas. Swoboda insists that eventually the world will buy into Cree's LED bulbs, bulbs that, even at a modest $8, still outcost their most expensive traditional equivalent. He also insists that the market, inflated with component supply from overseas, will stabilize and pricing will be on Cree's side once again. I have a very patient board, he says, of Cree's directors. While loyalty may be a factor in that patience, half of the board members have served in the role since 2008. The board will be expecting Swoboda to shift course in the coming months. Strategies could include increasing margins through new contracts, winning the pricing game with competitors, achieving success with its power and RF spin-out Wolfspeed, driving up stock prices through buybacks, or all of the above. For the Greater Triangle, however, more is at stake. With its deep-rooted history and strong local ties, a successful Cree story plays into the narrative of the Raleigh-Durham area's technology prowess and its ability to independently grow tech concerns that sustain themselves through the years. Swoboda steps in. In the beginning, the Durham company, freshly spun out of NC State University, was focused on silicon carbide, specifically chips. One application happened to be in LEDs, a technology that started to rise in the 90s, driven by the ballooning cell phone industry. In 2001, during the upper curve of that market growth, Swoboda, then chief operating officer, was called into then CEO Neil Hunter's office. Revenue, which had been increasing for like 20 straight quarters, had just missed the mark. Hunter said, "You know what, Chuck? It's time for you to be CEO," Swoboda recalls. But the freshman CEO faced a tough first year, making just one of his first four quarters. "Essentially, we were restructuring the business," he says. Cree changed course, embracing backlighting, what was called blue LED. Its LEDs took center stage in products such as televisions and cell phones. Cree had the components, and with the 2007 acquisition of Kotko, Luminant Device Limited, they had a way to package those pieces into an LED light. Other buys followed: LED lighting fixtures in 2008, Rund Lighting in 2011. Suddenly, the company was positioned to compete with its own clients with full-fledged fixtures. Rethinking the trifecta. In addition to the new lighting business, Cree's LED components unit was thriving, supplying Cree's own lighting fixtures as well as its new, buzzworthy consumer bulbs. The bulb strategy was pretty brilliant as long as they used their own chips, says Jed Dorsheimer, analyst for Canaccord Genuity, explaining that 80% of LED components used in lighting are driven by the LED bulb market. Since Cree made its own semiconductor chips, it could spread the cost among its other products, getting a lower-cost component to go into its own fixtures. It could then attack the market with lower prices in lighting. That was a marked adjustment from its semiconductor roots, but it was working. The strategy got the company to where it is today, a $1.65 billion in revenue, a big uptick from the $6 million company that went public in 1993. While the three segments, lighting, LED products, the power and RF products, the subsidiary currently being spun out, Cree thrived most of the past two decades. But the winds started gradually shifting a few years ago. Cree's bread-and-butter LED products business started to slow, and its lighting products started showing traction. Just 3 years ago, the LED products division, which makes the LED components, was nearly 60% of the firm's revenue. This past June, it had dropped to 37%, inking $602 million compared to $801.5 million in fiscal 2013. Cree saw the LED market segment's margins fall from 43% in 2013 to 32% in fiscal 2015. The lighting products division, which has lower margins, now controls more than half of Cree's top line. Asia, China force Cree's hand. Meanwhile, Asian-built components with mid-power, lower-priced LEDs began to flood the market, and Cree was in their direct path. And since lighting products were also gaining steam, Cree needed to acquire a company that would produce components with a lower price point to fulfill its big contracts with customers like Home Depot. Cree could no longer feasibly source its own LEDs for their product, says Dorsheimer. Cree turned to the very region pumping out the supply, acquiring a majority stake in a Taiwanese components maker, Lextar. As both supplier and customer, Cree had to figure out its pricing strategy for the products with the new mid-power components. Each component flows off a certain amount of lumens, Dorsheimer explains. You might have one high-power LED that is 1 watt, throwing off 200 lumens, and that might sell for 50 cents. But that mid-power, which is half watt, sells for 15 cents. So, by using two 15-cent components, customers are spending 30 cents to get the same lumen capacity as that higher-end 50-cent product. To cut costs in lighting, the company announced a bullish restructuring plan in that division, one expected to incur $85 million in charges, but Cree still ended its fiscal year in August with disappointing numbers, marking a weak end to a challenging year, noted J.P. Morgan analyst Paul Koster. The competitive landscape. Analysts agree on one thing, that Cree has become a lighting company, but it's not alone. Take Acuity, which just won a bid to provide LEDs for 30,000 streetlights in Raleigh, a city that had previously partnered with Cree in those initiatives. Acuity has built a distribution channel for selling lighting into the commercial and industrial market, a channel Cree doesn't have, says Dorsheimer. Cree is going to have to either be more aggressive with respect to pricing or deliver greater value, he says. And new innovations, inventions that promise that value, are spinning out all the time, threatening all established players. For instance, there's the technology David Carroll, professor at Wake Forest University, has been developing over the past few years. It's technically a hybrid that's similar to an OLED, organic light-emitting diode, which he says holds up better and with more efficiency than the LEDs on the market. He's targeting the greenhouse market, recognizing that with typical household use, there's a longer turnover time. Lamps that work at those ultimate limits will require replacements more often, Carroll says, adding that they'll see better efficiency than traditional products. It's his take that companies pushing out consumer bulbs are looking at the math wrong. I have lamps in my house that are LED lamps that have never been changed, he says. They tried to make them last as long as possible. As a corporate decision, was that good? Dorsheimer agrees. Those that say an LED bulb lasts a lot longer and therefore there's going to be a socket saturation, we agree, he says. But if the LED trend is only about that, then there won't be an ecosystem to exist here, he says. He says Cree's only chance is through innovation, because it's impossible to fight the commoditization that's occurring with the technology. Companies, governments, and other buyers find paying more for lighting without added value a tough sell. Pushing forward. Dorsheimer says one way companies are differentiating themselves is with management software. The LED lights themselves will just be a vehicle someday, he predicts. Imagine a smart connected streetlight that doubles as a Wi-Fi hotspot, literally becoming the network grid, or a light that changes colors in the event of a public emergency. He also hypothesizes that automatically dimming lights will be mandated in all office buildings, harvesting natural sunlight. The margins of the LED itself won't matter. But the bottom line is Cree, too, must innovate or else. Swoboda is well aware of the innovation piece. During his tenure, he hasn't been afraid to invest in those inventions. Over the past 5 years, the company has spent more than $778 million in research and development, and it increases year by year. The company spent $182.8 million in fiscal 2015. Compare that to just $32.5 million 10 years ago. The pressure is huge, but so is the opportunity. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, 9 billion lamps in the United States consume 20% of the nation's energy consumption. Couple that with the fact that LED bulbs are estimated to be nearly 80% more efficient than the incandescent equivalent, and the department estimates LED lighting could save the country enough energy by 2030 to power 24 million homes. J.P. Morgan's Koster says global light sockets exceed $30 billion, with lamps alone yielding a $15 billion addressable market opportunity. In a recent investment note, he says Cree's 940-plus U.S. patents and 1,800 foreign patents give it a significant competitive advantage, firmly establishing the company as a leader. Ted Connor, Senior Vice President of Economic Development and Community Sustainability for the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, calls the company an integral player in the triangle economy, quote, a very important component of our economic engine and is clearly a critical player in driving the future of the lighting industry, unquote. But it's more than just an employer to nearly 2,500 people in the triangle, and it's more than just tax revenue for Durham County. It's the homegrown story of a group of NCSU researchers who risked their savings, licensed their technology, and started a company that grew to employ more than 7,000 across the globe. In 1987, co-founder Neil Hunter was a 25-year-old salesman with an anemic savings account, teaming up with his brother Eric and a handful of researchers on the semiconductor materials startup, not possibly knowing the turns the company would take over the next three decades. Today, the company named for Hunter's father, Charles Cree Hunter, has transitioned from that startup to a sprawling LED giant. Swoboda says it can transition again. His plan is to do what he's been doing for the past decade and a half, follow the innovation. The question is how long will it take him to succeed on this new course, and whether he will be able to convince his board and largest institutional shareholders quick enough. If you watch us, we're pretty good at inventing the next one, he says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal, and the headline, Stakes Are High for Cree Community. For years, we've been reporting and opining about corporate incentives, downtown growth strategies, Jones Street foibles, and a sundry of issue-centric development. Seldom have we used this space in the paper to write about a single company or a single individual. True, in recent months, I wrote about Salix and how the deal was bad for the community, and why some of the major M&A exits by startups and young firms may look good in the short term, but offer challenges for us as we establish ourselves as a prime player in U.S. commerce and a standard for the corporate America of the future. I believe the Cree story is turning out to be very important. As you read through our cover story of this Durham company, understand two things. The first dollar was earned right here in the triangle, and the overwhelming part of its daily decision-making process continues to be handled out of the Silicon Drive offices in Durham. Today, Cree's revenue has topped $1.6 billion. With more than 2,000 workers in the Triangle and in excess of 7,000 worldwide, Cree is as much as an important story for us than, say, Quintiles, Red Hat, or SAS. If you are in business, you know every business has issues. It could be competition, innovation, markets, currency, pricing, or a slew of other things. For Cree, however, the issues are slightly more magnified. That's because gradually, its largest revenue-generating product is being commoditized. That means the company is at a price war with China, Taiwan, and a few other Asian counterparts. As a result, profit margins are disappearing as CEO Chuck Swoboda and his management team chart a way to find an alternate way to drive revenue and margins. As our story points out, Swoboda is doing various things, among which is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars in new money into research and development so Cree can introduce new lighting products that, frankly, may or may not have anything to do with light bulbs. You see, Cree's world changed not because it was underperforming. Cree's world changed because Asian competitors made the industry a price play rather than a quality play. Our appetite for cheap goods, such as LED light bulbs, fed the beast in the end. If Swoboda and his team are able to successfully pivot this organization by creating new products and an innovative sales model, the upside is huge. Cree becomes a large publicly traded consumer company, something the Triangle needs badly for branding purposes. It's a fascinating story that we will follow very closely. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Meet Morrisville's newest cricket player, the mayor. The town of Morrisville recently opened a regulation-sized cricket field, Church Street Park. The local team, Chicky Chicky Boom Boom, includes two members of the Morrisville Town Council, including Mayor Mark Stolman and Councilman T.J. Cawley. In an effort to understand the game of cricket better, I was offered a chance to play on a local team, Stolman told Biz. We are proud to have Alvin Kalacharan as our honorary coach. He is a cricket legend as he won the Cricket World Cup in 1975 and 1979 and was instrumental in bringing cricket to the Triangle. Chicky Chicky Boom Boom was headed to the Triangle Cricket League playoffs last weekend, but wet weather postponed the tournament. A new date had not been set as of our print deadline. Wet weather can't keep Raleigh from its big bluegrass blowout. Frankly, it was all amazing to Biz. Last weekend's bluegrass festival in downtown Raleigh was moved indoors at the last minute by the folks at the International Bluegrass Music Association. World of Bluegrass, the City of Raleigh, the Raleigh Convention Center, and the festival sponsors. We're talking a three-day outdoor event that spans multiple blocks in downtown being squeezed into a giant convention center within 72 hours. Biz grade, a big fat A. During the day on October 4, Biz talked to visitors, musicians, vendors, and organizers inside the RCC about the venue change, and all were unanimous that the experience was memorable. Convention center officials initially estimate about 50,000 to 60,000 people would have come to the festival during the week, down significantly from the 140,000 plus last year. But that was outdoors. Had the festival remained outdoors this year, Biz estimates less than 20,000 people would have shown up during the wet weekend. Anyway, you look at it, this was a logistical nightmare that went off almost without a hitch. Kudos to the organizers and the host city. Of course, having Branford Marsalis perform with the Kruger Brothers did not hurt. The Golden Bear stops in Chapel Hill. If folks in the Triangle heard a gentle roar in the early afternoon of September 29, it was golf's Golden Bear, Jack Nicklaus, celebrating the 25th anniversary of Governor's Club in Chapel Hill, a course he designed. Nicklaus and his wife Barbara were accompanied by some high-ranking Nicklaus Company officials and spent the day strolling around the 27-hole championship course that boasts the Jack Nicklaus signature course designation. Jack toured all 27 holes, met with the club's junior golf team, and capped the evening off by being interviewed by Gary Williams of the Golf Channel in front of a packed room of nearly 300 members. The club also unveiled its recent recognition as an Emerald Club, an awards program conducted by Boardroom Magazine, a private golf club trade pub. Nicklaus won a record 18 major championships on the PGA Tour during his playing career. Those include 6 Masters championships, 5 victories at the PGA Championship, 4 U.S. Open titles, and 3 British Open triumphs. Holly Springs pair on House Hunters. Holly Springs residents James and Jessica Amato were the stars of the October 1 HGTV network show House Hunters, which features prospective homeowners looking for that perfect house. James is the director of major gifts at United Way of the Greater Triangle. Jessica's the assistant director of the Institute for Private Capital at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School. Stan Parton, broker at Caldwell Banker, Howard Perry and Walston, showed the couple about 20 homes in Cary, Apex, and Holly Springs before finding them 3 houses to choose from for the show, 2 in Holly Springs and 1 in Apex. Jessica told Biz how difficult it was to be spontaneous and enthusiastic on camera. "I have a real respect for actors now," she says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, "History for Sale in Downtown Raleigh." The state of North Carolina is selling 8 properties in the capital city's Blount Street Historic District. Under orders of Governor Pat McCrory, the state property office is working to pare down the number of houses that the state owns within the Blount Street Historic District in downtown Raleigh. The state has in recent weeks begun offering for sale 8 historic home properties that are not currently being used for state agency offices and started the process of demolishing the dilapidated McGee House at 411 North Blount Street. The first 6 houses, located along the 400 block of North Person Street, are being listed at prices that range from $255,000 to $435,000. The 2 newest added to the list, though, are among the more prominent homes in the district. The noble Heck Andrews House at 309 North Blount Street, with its Second Empire style of architecture. And the 2-story Bailey Tucker House at 213 East Lane Street, across from the governor's executive mansion. Chris Mears of the State Department of Administration says the state has so far received 15 offers for the 6 historic but vacant homes on Person Street and are just beginning the evaluations needed for the sale of the Heck Andrews and Bailey Tucker houses. 6 other historic homes in the Blount Street District have already sold in recent years to private owners, including the Merriman Wynn House at 500 North Blount Street, that's now used as a wedding and event venue. When North Carolina state government leaders in the 1960s and 1970s started buying up many of the historic homes along Blount Street in downtown Raleigh, it was mostly to tear them down to build new office buildings and parking lots. In the 1970s, preservationists succeeded in convincing the state to protect many of these structures, and in 1976 designated the Blount Street Historic District that covers a 6-block stretch along North Blount Street. Some of the homes were converted into offices for state agencies, but many have fallen into serious disrepair. A report in June 2014 by the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division identified 17 state properties that were underused and were good candidates to sell. Among them were all of the houses now listed for sale, with the exception of the Bailey Tucker House. New future for Hillsborough Street's Velvet Cloak Inn. After several years of neglect and legal wrangling with former condo residents, the managers of the historic Velvet Cloak Inn on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh say they have full ownership of the property again and are putting it back on the market for sale. Owner David Smoot and his listing agents at Colliers International in Raleigh have not yet set a market price for the 174-room former hotel property at 1505 Hillsborough Street, but broker Stephen Peden says they do expect the site to fetch a price higher than the building's current tax value. Wake County pegs its tax value at $4.67 million based on the county's last evaluation in 2008. Built in 1962, the Velvet Cloak Inn was the first hotel built outside the downtown core and for many years was the choice hotel for celebrities visiting Raleigh. Peden is now marketing the 2.5-acre site to investors as a potential renovation, redevelopment, or repurpose site for student housing, conventional for rent apartment or assisted living, or a boutique hotel. Raleigh Standard Foods is now open for business. Standard Foods, the first of two new downtown Raleigh restaurants, planned by new restaurant partners Chef Scott Crawford and real estate investor John Holmes, opened for business finally on October 2. In addition to its restaurant, Standard Foods is slated to have a fresh foods and grocery section with its own fresh seafood and the butcher shop, currently being stocked and will open soon. The restaurant was originally scheduled to be open by the end of 2014. Owner of Rialto Theater to close Artsy Sister Cinema in North Raleigh. Movie cinema operator Ambassador Entertainment will be closing its Colony Theater on Six Forks Road in North Raleigh, known for its showings of mostly independent and foreign films, by the end of December. Ambassador co-owner Bill Peeble says the company will instead be reinvesting in renovations to the company's flagship, the Rialto Theater, near downtown Raleigh. Seven restaurants, shops commit to Costco Shopping Center in Apex. The developers of the new Nichols Plaza Retail Center that's under construction in Apex have confirmed lease commitments with seven new restaurants and retailers next to the new Costco store set to open in the spring on US 64. Costco's neighboring retailers in the first phase of development will include Chipotle Mexican Grill, Ruckus Pizza, Five Guys Burgers and Fries, McAllister's Deli, Mattress Firm, and Paris Nails. New Chick-fil-A on Lake Boone Trail sets date. The new Chick-fil-A restaurant building that's under construction in front of the Lake Boone Shopping Center in West Raleigh is wrapping up the final details and will open to the public October 14. The restaurant replaces a former Wendy's restaurant that was demolished earlier in the year. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, UNC Duke professors chat about Nobel Prize work. Professors from two Triangle universities were awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, becoming the third and fourth Nobel laureates from universities in this area. Aziz Sankar, a biochemist at UNC Chapel Hill, and Paul Modrick, a biochemist from Duke University, were each awarded the Nobel Prize for their DNA work. While their research has some overlap, they have published three papers together. It is distinctly different. An immigrant from Turkey, Sankar says he will donate the prize of about $950,000 to a foundation that supports students from Turkey who come to study at Triangle universities. Shortly after the ceremony, Sankar received a congratulatory call from the Turkish president. Sankar, who has been a professor at UNC since 1982, earned the award for his work on mapping the cellular mechanisms that underlie DNA repair, which occurs every single minute of the day due to outside forces such as ultraviolet radiation and other environmental factors. In particular, Sankar mapped nucleotide excision repair, which is vital to UV damage to DNA. When this repair system is defective, people exposed to sunlight develop skin cancer. Duke's Modrick was on vacation in New Hampshire when the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences announced the winners and joined the October 7 celebration at UNC by phone. "I'm stunned by this," he said. "It's overwhelming." Modrick was given the award for his four decades of work on how mistakes in the DNA code are repaired. The finding underlies the most common form of colon cancer and about 20% to 30% of other spontaneous tumors, as well as Huntington's disease and other neurodegenerative disorders. In 2007, Oliver Smithies, a UNC professor of pathology and laboratory medicine, also won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. In 2012, Duke professor Robert Lefkowitz won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Each was the first Nobel winner from the respective universities, which now remain tied at two apiece. Sankar joked about the rivalry between the universities that tends to play out in sports, but not in science. "Even though we all hate Duke, I have been nominating Modric for the past 10 years for the Nobel Prize," he said. Triangle Hospitals report strong year-over-year operating performance. Duke University Health System, UNC Hospitals, and Rex Healthcare each posted some of the best financial operating performances in recent memory. Broadly, there was not a sole reason for the improved performance, though the hospitals generally saw higher occupancy rates than the previous year. In addition, the hospital systems have implemented new electronic record systems, and as the doctors, nurses, and staff become more accustomed to the new system, they become more efficient, hospital executives have said. Community Care of North Carolina to share in federal grant $3.5 million in first year. Community Care of North Carolina Incorporated is one of 39 organizations, and the only one in North Carolina, to share in a $685 million grant awarded by the federal government to help patients interact with the healthcare system in a more cost-effective way. CCNC will receive $3.5 million in the first year and could receive up to $18.5 million over 4 years. CCNC is a private nonprofit that receives a payment from the state per Medicaid beneficiary it manages. It does not actually pay claims but helps coordinate care to reduce costly touch points with the healthcare system, like trips to the emergency room. A recent audit shows that CCNC helped save $312 per Medicaid beneficiary per year, about a 9% overall savings. With the federal grant called the Transforming Clinical Practice Initiative, CCNC says it will help some 3,000 clinicians in independent medical practices and safety net clinics improve care and reduce costs. It is unlikely that the organization will continue its current role when the reformed North Carolina Medicaid system takes full effect, although that will not happen for years. "We're extremely pleased to receive additional resources in our ongoing mission to support practice improvement, especially for rural and safety net providers serving the poor, elderly, medically fragile, and citizens living in rural areas of our state," said CCNC Incorporated President and CEO Dr. L. Allen Dobson, Jr. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onisorge. The first headline, Geolus, RTP's Park Center would welcome GE. Manufacturing conglomerate General Electric is reportedly considering a headquarters move. The Connecticut company has several states on its list, including North Carolina and Georgia, but it's staying mum on how those conversations are going, as are state commerce officials. "The team is currently engaged in the process and is taking many factors into consideration," General Electric spokesman Dominic McMullen said in an email. "When there is a final decision on relocation, we will communicate it publicly." One site that wouldn't turn General Electric away is Research Triangle Park, currently undergoing an urban renovation, starting with its most recently purchased tranche, Park Center. While he says he hasn't had any conversations with General Electric, Bob Geolus, head of Research Triangle Park's managing foundations, says he'd be more than open to discussions. The park site plan, which was touted in a press conference in late September, could accommodate 4 large corporate powers, he says, and that could mean General Electric. "Conversations with corporations will soon begin in earnest, but there has been interest in the site. Specifically, that interest came from Mercedes-Benz, which ended up moving its headquarters to Atlanta over RTP. When Mercedes was looking at this area and made a trip here, they were very interested in Park Center," he explains. "Now, Park Center, at that point, we did have a model to show them. We had a plan, but there were things we were still trying to accomplish, but we captured their imagination." Specifically, Mercedes was looking for a high-visibility site, at a Central Triangle location where they could tap into everybody. Livability, too, was a preferred feature, a need Park Center could have met with its planned residential blocks. While Giola says, "We would have made it work," he explains that the park is in a better position to accommodate a corporate giant today, having just secured $50 million in funding. Trust Atlantic deal closes, names to change. It's official, the parent company of First Tennessee Bank, First Horizon, has completed its acquisition of Raleigh-based Trust Atlantic. That means that on October 19, Trust Atlantic's five branches, four in the Raleigh-Cary Metro and one in Greenville, will open as First Tennessee branches. Jim Beck, CEO of Trust Atlantic and now Triangle Market President, managing commercial banking and branch operations for First Horizon, says the closure was pretty routine. The companies had plenty of time to prepare, as the deal was announced in late 2014. Beck says the only challenge remaining is the actual integration, which has been well rehearsed. Trust Atlantic is still on track to convert its entire system to First Tennessee's method the weekend of October 16. Customers have had concerns, and Beck feels they've been addressed over the past year. Customers want to make sure first that they'll be dealing with the same people, and that's the case, he says. The other is that they all have detailed questions about how their accounts will be handled and their checks will be handled. As for Beck, he doesn't expect his job to change for a few weeks. The merger did not include a mandatory employment contract for Beck, meaning he's still with the bank of his own volition. "My job for years and years has been making sure our customers have been taken care of," he says. Trust Atlantic has about $430 million in total assets, $368 million in total deposits, and $317 million in gross loans as of the end of June. And in a section called Deal of the Week, a buyout worth up to $150 million is subject to several conditions but could mean a big payday for a Mooresville firm. AtraCure, an Ohio-based surgical device firm, in the process of buying decade-old Mooresville-based medical device company NContact, says the stock cash buy increases its breadth in treating atrial fibrillation. While the deal must be approved by NContact stockholders, it does not have to be approved by AtraCure stockholders, and it's contingent on the absence of any material adverse effect on NContact's business, per a securities filing. And finally, in a He Said It section, the quote is from Joe Quinn, Senior Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for Walmart, during a recent NC State University visit, speaking on how the retail giant would be more than willing to take a look at consumer inventions out of Triangle entrepreneurship. A typical deal with Walmart starts with online sales, meaning a full scale-up wouldn't be necessary initially. And the quote is, "More so than in any point in Walmart history, we are willing to work with suppliers." And now we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The main headline, with Paris done, RDU sets sights on new destinations. Now that Raleigh-Durham International Airport has secured a nonstop flight to Paris, RDU officials are figuring out which cities to target next. RDU has identified a number of cities it intends to target for nonstop service based on traffic patterns at the airport. RDU hopes to land flights to Austin, Texas, San Diego, Kansas City, Missouri, San Juan, Puerto Rico, New Orleans, and Portland, Oregon. The airport is also tracking passenger movements to Canada, Mexico, and Asia in the hope of securing service to those locations. RDU already offers flights to Toronto and Cancun. "We have been very successful in securing air service to the top destinations we identified in our air service development policy," says RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. "But there are other destinations that are popular with our customers that we know can support daily nonstop service. It's been a good couple of weeks for RDU. On September 24, RDU announced it will begin offering nonstop service to Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport starting next May. That route is one business leaders in the Triangle have been pushing RDU to line up for years. Last week, Alaska Airlines began offering service from RDU to Seattle, marking the airline's first foray into the Triangle market. The first flight arrived from Seattle on October 1. Is this the end of the line for the Durham Orange Light Rail Project? With state funding for light rail projects currently in limbo, officials in Chapel Hill and Durham are plotting their next move for the proposed $1.8 billion line to connect Durham and Orange counties. The General Assembly did not approve a measure to change a provision in the state budget capping spending on light rail projects at $500,000. A bill to lift that cap cleared the House with overwhelming support, but the Senate referred the bill to the Rules Committee, effectively leaving the cap in place. Lawmakers have gone home for the year. "We're disappointed the cap is still there," says Chapel Hill Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt, "but we think it's a good sign that the House was willing to keep an open mind. The next step is to convince both houses." Kleinschmidt says his plan is to move forward as though nothing changed, continuing to gather feedback from the community. Go Triangle, the agency overseeing the proposed project, recently received a $1.7 million grant from the Federal Transit Administration to study ways to enhance the line's economic development potential. But it's hard to see how the project could continue without the state getting on board. While voters in Orange and Durham counties have approved a 1/2-cent sales tax to cover the local portion of the project, Go Triangle was supposed to get roughly $138 million from the state for the project over the next 10 years under the State Transportation Improvement Program. Support from the state will likely play into the federal government's decision on whether to provide funds. "We remain confident that the funding cap will be addressed in the future and are grateful for the support we have received for the project," says Go Triangle General Manager Jeff Mann. "We continue to believe the Durham Orange Light Rail Transit Project provides the best transportation solution for the Durham to Chapel Hill corridor." John White, Vice President of Public Policy at the Greater Durham Chamber of Commerce, says he plans to push for the cap to be lifted next year during the short session. He's anticipating a tough road ahead, given 2016 is an election year. "A lot of politics could play into the issue next year," White says. A recent poll of Chapel Hill residents conducted by Public Policy Polling found that 69% of respondents support building a light rail line between Durham and Chapel Hill. And finally, we have a By the Numbers section. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has begun distributing millions of dollars in gas tax funds to local municipalities. The funds will go toward improving local roads as well as bikeways, greenways, and sidewalks. The funds are allocated based on a set formula, with 75% of the distribution based on population and 25% on the number of locally maintained streets. $147.7 million. Total amount of gas tax funds that will be distributed, 507. Number of municipalities that applied to receive funds, $10.6 million. Amount Raleigh will receive from NCDOT. Raleigh ranked number 2 behind Charlotte in the amount it will receive. $6.2 million. Amount Durham will receive. The Bull City was the only other Triangle city to receive more than $1 million. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, written by Todd Cohen, who publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Catholic Charities Focuses on the Poor. Every Saturday and Sunday at the Oak City Outreach Center, just off Moore Square in downtown Raleigh, volunteers feed 4 meals a day to a total of 875 homeless people. Coordinating 40 to 45 volunteer groups that take turns preparing and serving the meals at the center, housed in the city-owned former Salvation Army warehouse, is Catholic Charities, an arm of the Catholic Diocese of Raleigh. Catholic Charities serves 54 counties in the eastern half of the state, a region in which 1 in 5 children grows up in a household that is poor. It works to address the needs of the poor not met by other agencies, providing 65,000 to 70,000 people per year with emergency assistance, programs aimed at reducing poverty, and clinical mental health services. We are Catholic, and because of our faith, we serve people who come in the door, regardless of their faith, and in a way that tries to meet the need they present to us, says Gary Skinner, Executive Director of Catholic Charities. At Oak City Outreach Center, the agency coordinates volunteer groups on behalf of the center's three partners, including the Raleigh-Wake Partnership to End and Prevent Homelessness and the City of Raleigh. Now, the partnership, the city, and Wake County have selected Catholic Charities to be the operating partner in developing a new Oak City Center, which will offer multiple services for the county's homeless population. To be developed in 2 to 3 years and financed with private and public dollars, the new center will serve as a one-stop shop to refer homeless people in Raleigh to the health and human services that they need and as a central repository of data on services to the homeless. Catholic Charities will work with the community and the three partners to develop an integrated system of services, such as consolidated intake services or showers and laundry facilities, to the homeless population, Skinner says. Catholic Charities operates with an annual budget of $5 million, 54 employees, and 450 to 500 regular volunteers, and counts on the diocese for a little more than one-fifth of its budget. In each region it serves, Catholic Charities designs its services to meet local unmet needs, Skinner says. In Durham, for example, it provides about $100,000 per year in financial assistance to about 500 families. In Raleigh, Greenville, and Wilmington, it provides immigration services, and by the start of 2016 will expand them to Burlington, Fayetteville, and Goldsboro. Catholic Parish Outreach, a food pantry that is Catholic Charities' single biggest program, in its most recent fiscal year distributed $3.5 million worth of food to 48,000 people, mainly in Wake, Johnston, and Franklin counties. Individuals may visit the food pantry once per month to get a week's worth of food, typically driven by the uncertainty of living on the edge in a tough economy. Catholic Charities provides people with food and other assistance to meet their immediate needs, Skinner says, and we work to help them become economically self-sufficient. And in nonprofit news, Kangaroo Express supports NC troops. Kangaroo Express, part of Alimentation Couchetard Incorporated, donated $1.58 million on behalf of its summer-long Salute Our Troops fundraising program in support of military and their families during the Ray Price Harley-Davidson Capital City Bike Fest. The donations collected during the 2015 campaign bring the total amount of funds raised over the past five summers to more than $11 million. These donations directly support Fisher House Foundation, the United States Veteran Corps, and six state-based military support organizations, including USO of North Carolina and the Soldiers and Airmen Assistance Fund of North Carolina. John Deere partners with Wake Habitat. The Cary offices of the John Deere Agriculture and Turf Division partnered with Habitat for Humanity of Wake County to build a home for a local family at Evans and Rochelle Roads in Cary. The John Deere Foundation provided financial support, and local John Deere employees worked with the family and other volunteers to complete the build. Decorate doors for anti-drug campaign. In an effort to educate youth and prevent drug use, the National Family Partnership invites families and schools to participate in the National Red Ribbon Week photo contest. Decorate the front door of your home or school. Upload a photo to redribbon.org/contest by November 3 and encourage family and friends to vote. This year, $20,000 will be awarded. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read the Executive Voice question and answer column, and this one focuses on Sidney Hinton. A closer look at Sidney Hinton, his company, Power Secure, age 53, family, four children, two grandchildren, education, a BS in accounting, Georgia State University, MBA, Emory University, hometown, Atlanta, but I consider Raleigh my hometown. The headline on the column, Flipping the Switch to Lower Energy Bills. Power Secure eyes its next big market, data centers. And this is written by Jeff Jeffrey. As Hurricane Joaquin barreled toward the East Coast, many businesses moved into crisis mode, preparing for heavy rains and flooding. But it's moments like those when Wake Forest-based PowerSecure shines. The company, which celebrates its 15th anniversary this year, specializes in providing backup power to large commercial and industrial operations. But as an added bonus, PowerSecure provides businesses with the ability to pull themselves off the power grid during peak use times, saving them money in the process. By building all of their generators and switchgears themselves, PowerSecure has been able to cut costs and make their product more competitive. It's a market that brought in $257 million for the company in 2014. PowerSecure President and CEO Sidney Hinton says the publicly traded company has identified providing backup power and peak shaving solutions to data centers as the next big market opportunity, and it's one he says could really let the company break out. Where did the idea to combine backup power and peak shaving come from? I grew up at Southern Company and later Georgia Power Company in Atlanta, and I learned about distributed generation. But back in the late 90s, the utilities didn't want to do it. Our perception was, if we drive a lot of the cost out of this and a lot of the functionality into this, then we can create a market here where people could justify it. Who provided the seed money for you all to get going? A public company called Metrotech put up the money. They got 85% of the business, and I got 15%. The initial acquisition they made was all stock. We gave all stock and employment contracts. We didn't have one dime of cash to give, but they very much bought into the vision. It was a wonderful blessing to PowerSecure and our team. The original investment was $250,000, and they let us borrow $2 million. We paid the $2 million back the next year. The first big break for your company was in the grocery store market. How did you identify that as an opportunity? Before us, no grocery stores did peak shaving. They often had small systems that would manage the cash registers. We call it an exit generator. It keeps the lights on long enough to allow you to shut everything down and get people out of the store. Then they'd just pray the power came back before the products had to be thrown away. Once that business took off, we saw another opportunity in the industrial space. How are you able to manage power systems for hundreds of customers across the country, many of which are operating on separate power grids? We had to invest in the technology from day one. We had to in order to drive our warranty expense down. If you look at other companies, they'll have a whole bunch of people working to manage their system. That's not the case with us. When you see a lot of people running around, it means they have no technology. You've said data centers are the next big opportunity for PowerSecure. Why is that? They're a massive opportunity for us. The scale of those projects is at least 10 times the size of our biggest prior projects. They're complex by design. They require enormous levels of reliability. All of that lends itself to the controls and capabilities we have generated over the last 15 years. PowerSecure has made acquisitions to move into the solar, LED, and data center businesses. How does the company approach strategic acquisitions? We tend to go after teams of phenomenal people. We typically find a company that is in financial distress for some reason, and we grow them. Take the data centers business. We became aware of a really talented team from PDI, Power Design Incorporated, data center business, about a year ago. We bought them for $15 million and will do about $40 million in sales. Earlier this year, PowerSecure was hired by the Bahamas Electricity Corporation to help them address high power costs and reliability issues. Is that the start of a new line of business? We hope so, but first we want to deliver great service to the Bahamas. They've got a situation on their utility system in which they're in great need of maintenance. We're excited about it and helping to increase the reliability of electricity while decreasing the cost of that electricity. If we do that, we hope it will help to garner customers in other island nations. Tell us about your hobbies. I like to hunt and fish, though I rarely shoot when I go hunting. I'll carry a gun, and I love turkey hunting. I love how smart they are, and I love the peace of deer hunting, but rarely do I take an animal. Who has had the biggest influence on your career? My dad. Growing up cutting yards, he told me, "Don't worry about what you're getting paid. Worry about the reputation you build. It's not about today's payday. It's about building a good reputation." And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can from the Viewpoint page, the column written by Heidi Nolte, who is Director of Career Services at the Art Institute of Raleigh-Durham, part of the Art Institute's system of more than 50 schools throughout North America. The headline, "Don't Let Talent Head Toward the Exits." Talent is the triangle's ticket. It's what keeps business leaders both smiling at our prosperity and worried about its longevity. It's the hymn sung by elected officials and economic developers, and I can tell you firsthand that it's always on the minds of people who run our schools and colleges. When we talk about talent, we mean a steady supply of men and women with the skills and critical thinking capabilities necessary to continue the growth of existing businesses and fuel the creation of new ones. Leaders at area tech companies have noted that the local talent supply isn't quite strong enough in the areas of STEM, science, tech, engineering, and math. And a recent report by the Brookings Institute entitled "Still Searching, Job Vacancies and STEM Skills" backs them up. But the need for talent cuts across all business categories. It's of concern to tech companies, yes, but also, for example, to top-notch restaurants. In Raleigh, for example, the latest eatery from AC Restaurants features a sign reading, "Now Hiring Badasses." The fact is, talent underwrites the way of life we treasure in the Triangle, from the corporate campuses of RTP to the award-winning restaurants in our resurgent downtowns. As the new head of career placement at the Art Institute of Raleigh-Durham, a campus of South University, I'm fairly obsessed with the cultivation of talent. Working with an educational institution smaller than, say, Duke or NC State, I get a close-up view of what it takes to shape someone with promise into bona fide talent ready for hire. Here are four key lessons I've learned. Talent requires different kinds of educational opportunities. Talent requires mentors. Talent wants to get its hands dirty. And talent isn't afraid to shift and restart careers. And the article goes into more detail on those four key lessons, but we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.